don't want to blow our lead here.
Yeah, and there will be handouts from one of the public speakers. You can send that or don't. It's up to you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through.
All right, let's go ahead then with the meeting. At the close of the initial session, I'm not sure if this was mentioned for the record, but there was no committee correspondence, so that there was no need for discussion. One thing that was brought to my attention later, we will be discussing after lunch the nominated condition of the 22Q11 deletion syndrome, a summary statement of the nomination and prioritization work group report is in the agenda book, but the nomination packet was not included. Therefore, it is being emailed to members of the committee now so that it will be available to you so that you will have that. We're going to now move to Sarah. Sarah is going to talk about orientation to the current charter processes and procedures. There will be a requirement for a vote at the end of her presentation, but as she goes through the different issues, our approach is that as the issues come up, we'd like some discussion about each of them as they're brought forward. So, Sarah.
Thanks. I have a joke, just to preface this so you know to laugh, okay? I've already tried it out on Chris and he said it was okay. So, have you heard of OCD? I have CDO. It's like OCD, but the letters are in the right order. And that just kind of should set up my whole talk because that's just really where I'm at. So, I'm all about form and structure and function. So I wanted to talk to you guys about this. We're working on some changes, and it is to provide some structure to the current processes and procedures. As we learn as we go along, and I am OCD enough that I really do need to have some structure for us to work on, and hopefully it'll make things smoother. And especially as we go forward with this renewal in 2013, we want to make sure that we've dotted all our I's and crossed all our T's, and especially that we're meeting our legislative requirements. I don't know if you've noticed, but with RASP and other things, the stature and visibility of this advisory committee are growing. And we want to make sure that our processes and our recommendations are very well thought out and put forward in an organized manner. And it's kind of time to look back. We're at 26 meetings now. Let's look back, review the current legislation, and make sure that we're meeting all of our requirements. So these are the five different topics that I'm going to go over. And there should be an order to it. You will see my OCD coming out. And I'd like to discuss it after each topic so we don't get to the very end and you guys have to remember what I spoke about five slides ago. So the first topic is going to be the condition review. The current process, which I'm sure all of you are very aware of, or most of you, Dr. Liu, it's okay, don't learn the old way. We're changing it. So the current process has six real core questions that they run through. Does screening improve outcomes? Is there a case definition and what's known about it? The prevalence, spectrum of disease, natural history, test for the disorder, been validated? What's the clinical utility of the test? How cost effective is screening, diagnosis, and treatment for this disorder compared to usual care? And this is the algorithm. that they worked, the evidence review group worked really hard to come up with, and I think it's a very good algorithm. The proposed revision takes that algorithm and just adds one more step. And it's number 7, is what is the impact on public health for screening this disorder? The impact on the health of the public and the impact on the public health system. And that's the proposed revision, is that we add another step in the condition review. So it's not just going to be an evidence review, it's going to be a condition review. And the rationale for this is it's in our legislation. We have to be able to evaluate the potential public health impact of any of the disorders that we add to the ROSP. So we are trying to harmonize or collaborate with other evidence review processes across the federal government, one of which is the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and the other is the Community Guide for the Public Health Evidence, and try and come up with a process that is a crosswalk between the two. Currently, we have a steering work group for this, and we will review and present it to the advisory committee. The plan is, and I'm going to hold Alex's feet to the flame for this, is to have a model for you guys to review in May. So one thing just to keep in mind for this, if the public health impact has not been assessed, then it does not fulfill the model decision matrix provisions for newborn screening, expansion and updates to the ROSP. And so these are things to consider. Questions or comments? Yes.
I just think this is a terrific development, and I'm just strongly supportive of the inclusion of this element. I think it's going to improve the overall process and really help states incorporate the recommendations into their state policies and procedures. So, great.
Good. Are Fred Laurie and Charlie Homer on the phone?
Yes. I had a little trouble hearing the last person, but as you described it, I guess I'll just ask the question. Is this in any way going to detract from what the committee's standards are in evidence-based review? When you talk about public health effects, et cetera.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Fred.
I'm just concerned about, you know, various organizations that will not pay attention to the secretary's recommendations. Is this in any way going to dilute that by adding this component?
From my standpoint, and of course you're going to get a kind of biased answer, which would be no, but I think I mean, just to be honest, but I also think that in collaboration with the USPSTF or the task force, I think actually it'll make the recommendations even stronger. But we're not really changing the evidence review. We're just taking the condition review one step further to include the public health impact, which we have to have according to the legislation. So unless the legislation gets changed, we really have to have it.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
And in the opposite direction, you don't think it will affect when the committee makes a recommendation not to screen?
No, we're not changing the choosing matrix at all.
Okay.
Thank you. Denise had a question first.
Yeah, I agree with both of these, but I guess I don't see the connection between revamping the review process and aligning more closely with the USPSTF and the community guide. That seems to be a separate issue to me.
So the USPSTF and the community guide, we're trying to correlate with them because that way we can actually maybe streamline efforts. So if we have an evidence review process that is amenable to the task force, then the conditions that they might be asked to review, like PKU or whatever, is they would accept our evidence review in place of doing their own. And if we get something that's more appropriate for the task force or for the community guide in terms of screening, that we would in turn develop a mechanism for possibly referring it to them.
But the connection to the public health impact? I mean, so would we take a U.S. Preventive Services Task Force or community guide recommendation and then take the step of having the public health impact of that done? Because the Preventive Services Task Force doesn't do a public health impact.
Whatever we look at will have to have a public health impact. And the community guide, we're collaborating with them in order to use their experience as opposed to their whole process, because they have the public health impact built into their system. Just Colleen was first.
So first of all, I think this is an excellent recommendation, and I also think it does track back to the actual law and the recommendations. I feel like the committee had tried to do that, so I'm going to ask a little bit of a process question so I better understand it, and maybe those around the table too. So I'm assuming you're not talking about the evidence review itself. That will continue to go as outlined. But that after the evidence review is done, this would be a follow-up to that process?
More or less, yeah. But instead of having two separate groups do it, we'll have, at one point in time, we considered having two separate groups do it, but we're going to have it all be done as a condition review as opposed to, yeah. And I don't know if Alex wants to comment, but I think that my impression has been that the evidence review really hasn't had a public health impact focus, and it needs to be clearly delineated. Don?
Partly was going to ask the same question that Colleen asked. I do support this direction. I think it's very important for us to think about the public health ramifications of our recommendations. I was curious about who would be responsible for gathering the data on this, and then, but related to that, will this be what kind of data will we be asking for in terms of making this decision? I think if we're asking for the same kinds of data that we're asking in terms of the evidence review group, that's going to be very challenging because it really will require implementation studies, cost effectiveness studies, process studies, so I don't know if the decision matrix will address that. I don't know, but I think it's going to be an important question because if we're asking for hard-nosed data on it, that's going to really delay a lot of our decisions.
And that's exactly, I can't tell you what it's going to ask for. I think we're going to take the models from the community guide and other models for health impact analysis and try and incorporate it into a model. But what we're asking for will definitely, has not been determined yet. That's the purpose of the work group.
Okay.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, one of the comments is I think we've had discussions about public health impact in the group, and I think the idea of saying this needs to be part of it is a good idea. It means that the evidence-based group will comment on this? That's going to be part of their report?
They're going to be the condition review group. So I'm changing the name, but not only that,
but it's the same.
It's going to, the
folks
process,
that are going to expand their.
Yeah, the process is going to be expanded to include the public health. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Colleen.
Just one more clarification. So we'll hear this next time, sort of a draft consideration of how to include this in our process.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. Okay. So that's the first proposal. The second one is voting on the conditions. And the current process right now is the evidence review group presents their data to the advisory committee. And at several different points in time, the advisory committee discusses and votes, and it could include recommendations and adding a condition to the RUSP. The proposed revision is not great, but it starts to include the advisory committee or two specific members of the advisory committee from the very start in listening to the evidence review and hearing what the evidence is from the very beginning. And they, in turn, frame a perspective of recommendations so that when the evidence review group presents, much like with the hyperbilirubinemia condition today, the AC members also present what they would recommend the advisory committee do. However, this is not binding. It is up for discussion. But again, my OCD and my framework comes into play. And it provides a framework for the discussion as opposed to having all the evidence given to you and say, vote. And the reason for this is really there's not enough time for the full discussion of pros and cons. I don't care how long we have. There's just a lot of thinking that needs to be done. And it's very similar to the process we currently have for the prioritization and nomination work group in, regarding evidence review. And as I said, it allows for a framework and reference point and more participation by the advisory committee from the very start. Okay, so questions or comments on this? Yes, Denise.
As you know, I've had concerns about having two AC members kind of take the lead on this because of past experience. And I'm not sure what it means to have the AC members present a perspective versus present their recommendation to the committee, and whether they'll be presenting, in effect, a recommendation to the committee.
I'm going to have Joe answer that because this was his is based on his previous experience with ACIP.
Yeah, and I think that the term is probably better, recommendations to the committee, because I think that the two advisory committee members will really serve as the voice of the committee. They will be involved in the sense that they will, based on what they understand the decision has to be made, provide back to the evidence review group what the committee may need to make a decision, and then they will be up to date on the data as it becomes available, so that they can then make preliminary recommendations to the committee for the committee to vote on. When those recommendations come to the committee, they will come from the two members. Those two members will then have the rationale, background, and the reasons for those decisions. The committee will then look at those recommendations and, based on their understanding of the data, potentially revise, accept, or recommend changing those recommendations. But I think what this does is it provides two members with the a good look at the data as it's being developed, an opportunity to develop formal recommendations so they can focus the discussion of the working group, of the entire committee. And I think what this does is it enables the committee to then make a better decision. This ACIP has been doing this for years. In fact, the working group that is set up for individual vaccines or recommendations always consists of a members of the ACIP, and they are responsible for, along with the CDC lead, updating the entire committee as necessary on background information, also that they inform the committee along the route so that when the vote is ready, the committee is up to date. But then the recommendations come specifically from that committee, and then they're modified by the entire committee from the working group.
So could you say a little bit more about how these two members get selected and who they are?
Yeah,
I think we've had some issues before with the committee members being selected who are advocates for a certain condition being mm-hmm. included. And then it's been very difficult for the committee as a whole to go against that recommendation.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, and it's something that we need to be very careful as we select committee members to serve. Obviously, the committee members need to be chosen because they have some expertise, but that they are going to be able to provide the information, that they're going to be able to, in an objective way, look at the data and make recommendations to the committee based on the committee's responsibility for making a formal recommendation for whether to include the condition in the recommended uniform screening panel. So I think it's going to be very important for the committee to choose effectively those individuals who will serve, and I'm sure the responsibility is primarily going to be mine and Sarah's for that to happen in an effective way.
So one suggestion is that, given our past experience, we kind of have a trial period of doing this rather than have it implemented as a final recommendation. But it's up to the committee to vote.
Okay. Obviously. Well, in a sense, we're going to try that with the hyperbilirubinemia presentation tomorrow. We have selected two committee members to work with the group, and they are going to come forward with some recommendations to the committee. The committee has all the data. The final report from the committee from the evidence review group will be made tomorrow, and then two committee members will come forward with some recommendations to help frame the discussion. Let's see how that goes.
Yes, Don.
So I'm very much in favor of setting up some processes of things that happen in between the meetings so that we can have more efficient, make our meetings more efficient. I do think we have to think very carefully about who these people are, and also about what are the multiple perspectives represented with respect to the criteria that we'll ultimately be using, and especially when you're adding the public health impact question. So I wonder if we might want to think about a strategy where maybe the chairs of the three or maybe four, however many subcommittees that we have constitute this group, because the education committee, for example, or the follow-up and treatment group will certainly have some advice or some, they'll take the perspective not just of the condition but also the public health impact of it, the impact on for providers and so forth. And if we set up a, I don't know if we can or should have a formal executive committee of the chair and the subcommittee chairs, but that might be a more formal mechanism for something like this that would help. And if the subcommittees represent the broad range of themes that this committee is supposed to address, and each committee is a member of one of the subcommittees, that might help. I don't know, Denise, if that would address some of your concerns or not.
That's a burden to put on the subcommittee chairs, who already have quite a big burden. Yeah. So, I think, but the selection process needs to be really thought through. Right. So,
Colleen.
This is one idea. We could just be very explicit about conflicts of interest. You know, subject matter experts maybe don't, people who have invested interest, who have worked for years and really want to push the issue. I mean, they shouldn't be those representatives. You know, we want a fair, objective voice there. They could serve as SMEs, but not necessarily these committees. So somehow just being explicit about that.
Yeah. The nice thing about this is the determination of who's on, who is in the, who works with the evidence review is in the policies and procedures, and so it doesn't have to be decided today, but this is something to consider as we go forward with the policies and procedures. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, process question. Do you anticipate that the two members will prepare separate recommendations, or they'll get together and present one, and will those recommendations be available to the committee prior to the meeting, or would that be presented at the time of the meeting for the other committee members?
I'll let Joe answer.
Yeah, I think ultimately, as we go through this, I think the best thing to do would be to have that presented prior to the meeting with the agenda book, so that it is available to everybody to review and consider. And I think that would then help frame things even better. I think also as part of this is that this is a process, and so that really is the end of the process. And by having the evidence review group and the two committee members working in concert, as a working group can come forward to the committee at various time frames with data on the background, other aspects of whatever the condition is, so that the committee is informed along the way, and so that the committee is then ready to look at recommendations when they come forward, when the evidence review is completed. So, but the goal would be that the evidence review, at the time of its completion, when it's coming up for a vote, recommendations would be available to committee members before the meeting.
Are there any comments on the phone from Fred or Charlie?
No, thank you. This is Charlie.
And from the liaisons? Okay. Next topic. So here's where my OCD comes in again, is I like processes. And I would like to have a formal process for reports and products. Currently, reports are presented to the advisory committee. The recommendations are decided on and they're sent to the secretary. What I would like to have is each report or product reviewed by the appropriate subcommittee, which most of them are right now. And that, but this allows for potential of outside products that groups want to have considered could be referred to the subcommittees then. And if deemed appropriate for further processing, will be presented to the advisory committee for official support. And the support would have four different levels. The first would be official advisory committee support, which is high. And this is when it is important to the field of the newborn screening. It is in the purview of the advisory committee. It's under the authority of the secretary, and there are actions to be taken. The second would be an affirmation of value to the newborn screening committee. It's important, but it's maybe not in the purview of the advisory committee or maybe not in the authority of the secretary to make these recommendations. However, it does go forward to the secretary for information only. And it is also noted that it was voted to have an affirmation of value by the advisory committee itself. The third would be an acknowledgement that this report was presented. It is important but not actionable. It's not in the purview of maybe the secretary or the advisory committee. It's not sent forward to the secretary for even informational purposes, but it's acknowledged as being, you know, of discussion, a note of topic, a topic of discussion, and or else no support. And the rationale for this is our value is built on our reputation, and it's gained through our expertise, achievements, and objectivity. And we want to make sure that we appropriately support at different levels materials that benefit the community. Not all reports require secretarial action or review, and this allows for support by the advisory committee, but doesn't require the secretary to maybe step out on a limb and say yes or no to it. Yes, Don.
Are you intentionally limiting this to newborn screening, or is it more to the
if it's in the scope of the legislation, which includes heritable disorders.
Right, so maybe you change some of the language.
Definitely. Yes, Denise.
Could you go back to the slide before this one? Number three says important but not actionable, but number two does not address actionability.
Number one is the one that has the action. So number three doesn't go forward to the secretary. Number one is for those that have actions. Okay. Number two is for those that are for informational purposes only, but goes forward to the secretary. Okay. The third would be those that the advisory committee acknowledges as being important, but there's no actions, and we're not going to send it forward.
Okay. I probably have worse OCD than you do then, because it might be important in number two to say important but not actionable because it's neither in the purview of the AC or something.
Okay.
Like that.
Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, just a language issue. I wonder if we might change that left column to nature of support, because I think there's going to be things in two or three that the committee thinks are high level of support, but they're just not, as described in the second column, fitting within certain. So I don't think we want to dilute the level of support with moderate language here. So maybe nature of support, okay, given the nature of the document.
Definitely. Colleen?
I'll let Joe Lee go first.
Okay,
following the rules here. So I guess I'm thinking about I'm trying to put this into practice, which mm-hmm. is always helpful for me, mm-hmm. Translation. And so I'm thinking of some of the products from our subcommittee that will be presented tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a gray area between one and two for me. Because I get stuck on the action part of it for two, because I do feel like some of our products from our subcommittee, we want affirmation of value by the committee. So we want them to be products of the committee.
Right.
I don't think there's necessarily an action for the secretary other than FYI.
Right.
But I also don't think I agree with important, but neither in the purview of the advisory committee under the authority. I'm getting confused on
the
that
language.
One.
The language needs to be revised.
Okay.
Obviously, we're not policy experts, okay. But this is the idea being, and it's a concept at this point in time.
I'm okay with this part of it. I'm not sure I'm okay with the action.
But the bottom line is, number one, goes to the secretary and has action. Number two goes to the secretary for FYI.
Okay.
Number three is voted on and approved by the advisory committee, but doesn't go anywhere else. And number four is we don't think that this is something we want to have our name associated with. Yes, Denise.
But I think we need another process underneath this one for what it means to have SACDINC, if I can use that, support. It doesn't mean that the entire committee has to agree. Does it have to be a majority? Can it just be the chair?
It has to be voted upon. This is like voting upon a condition. So it would be majority. Yes. Okay, now to Dr. Simpson, I'm sorry.
This is a non-voting comment. Since the charge of the committee is beyond newborn screening but heritable disorders in general, I wonder, as long as you have the levels of support codified on the slide for us, whether you would comment what would happen if we extended it beyond newborn screening. For example, whole genome sequencing is, you know, around the corner. We're going to find out lots of information, and I know as a fact you've had that discussion, but where would that fit into this plan, the unintended and serendipitous findings that you have? Is it a 3? Is it a 4? Is it come back to a 2, or where?
So what it introduces a different level of the conversation. It needs to be within the scope of the advisory committee, but that does include heritable disorders. And so if it wasn't a clear-cut newborn screening related product, we would make sure that we had our legal counsel just make sure that they agreed with us that it was within the scope of the committee and the legislation, and it gets back to the legislation and what the scope is outlined there, which is quite broad, very broad. Yeah, Dr. Cuss.
I'm trying to understand. The committees usually have priorities of what they're working on, including some products.
Right.
Does this create added work that somebody would submit a report to the committee and say, I want some action to it? Is it as they nominate conditions?
It's a similar process, and one of the areas I can think of that this might be of use and would be in our legislation, the advisory committee is to report on and develop issues related to quality indicators and newborn screening. At this point in time, no one's working on it in the committee, but there are groups outside of the committee working on it. And instead of trying to recreate that work, once those quality indicators are validated and approved, to have that work presented first to the lab standards and procedures subcommittee. And if seen as being valuable and something the advisory committee should vote on, then brought forward to the advisory committee. But realizing that there's other people that are working on heritable disorders outside of this committee that I think would be valuable for everybody to know about.
Just to follow up, have we had something that's come to us and said what that would go through this process previously?
No.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? On the phone?
No, thank you.
Okay. So there's your reports and products. And last is, I think this is last, I could be wrong, is term limits for non-voting members. Currently, we have up to 12 positions. The appointments are based upon a written request from organizations, and nominations are sent to me, to the Associate Administrator, Maternal and Child Health Bureau, HRSA, the committee, and the secretary, ultimately. Once nominated, there's no limit to the time despite rapidly changing landscapes. So what we would like to do is develop categories of liaisons to be determined with a set number of representatives in each of those categories. And these will be developed by HRSA and the ex officio members, the categories, at some point in time. And every 4 years, the liaison position will roll off and be selected or be selected for another four-year term. So the rationale is all of our voting members have term limits, and this is the purpose of this is to get new influx of new ideas. Newborn screening and heritable disorders encompasses a huge catchment, and there are important stakeholders other that 12 positions alone can fulfill. And it allows for an equity in the distribution of influence upon the advisory committee. Yes, Alexis.
Do you anticipate not only the person, but the organizations then changing?
It is the organization. If there's no one, if they're selected through the nomination process will be very similar to that for the members, but it will be at the organization level as opposed to the person level. Questions on the phone? Liaisons. Yeah, Chris.
So you're moving us to the outside table and then we fall off the table. Is that what you're saying? I'm just checking.
Well, that's a thought. Yeah. We're going to put a trap door under you.
That was my one joke for today.
Yeah. Going to put a trap door under you. But, you know.
Is that
yeah.
the process?
Okay. Yeah. Either that or the gong show, one way or the other. Yes. Natasha, did you have a comment?
I did. When would that 4 years start? Is that from when they...
We're going to stagger them because I don't want to do a nomination package for 12 members.
Okay.
So you'll be notified, but no one's rolling off this year. Okay. It would start in the next year or so, and you'll be notified when you would roll off and okay. how that would work.
All right, great.
We don't have a process for that. It's an idea. Yes, Alexis.
What if an organization's, from their point of view, that the person that, say that organization is selected for continued representation, but that organization decides that that liaison, that individual really is their most effective person for this committee, do they have any control over the ability to maintain that person on the committee, or must that person change no matter what?
No, not at all. It is a position for the organization, which is what it is currently, and it's at the discretion of the organization to name who sits at that table. Okay. And this is just kind of a policy procedure thing. Currently, our policies and procedures include all the details that are considered bylaws as well. So we've got a mishmash of everything. So at our recommendation by legal counsel, we are separating out the bylaws from the policies and procedures because you guys don't want to have to vote on every time we change a word in the standard operating procedures. So the bylaws are require formal vote by the advisory committee. And again, this is to align it with what the FACA legislation says. And that's just kind of a formal note for you guys to know. And any comments or questions on that? You should have a copy of the revised bylaws, and you do have one in your briefing book. And you also have a draft of the revised policies and procedures, which is more a programmatic decision, but just to give you an idea, I covered it all in my talk, or the broad strokes. So the vote today is for approval of the bylaws. An aye vote would result in immediate implementation of new processes that do not require a change to the charter.
So before we go forward, are there any additional comments or questions? Andrea?
I have a question about the other members, the non-voting members, and having them rotate off in the four in the process, because I think that there's some value of having certain stations that are there that don't vote, that I like to see stay there.
They can renominate themselves to stay on. And so it's not like they automatically roll off. But in that, that's part of the policies and procedures we haven't established yet about if there would be set seats at the table or not. But at this point in time, the plan is that they can renominate themselves, and if they're the best nominee for that category, then they would maintain the seat.
Okay, if there are no additional comments, oh, Colleen?
Just a clarification of what we're voting on. So on the bylaws, those highlighted sections are the changes?
Yes.
Because it was hard to...
Okay. Yes, yes. Great. The highlighted changes are the changes to the bylaws, and those are what you are voting on today.
Right, and then the language changes of the rest of the part of that, well, that is not what's being voted on today. Those would be adjustments that would subsequently be made independent of this vote. So we need a nomination from the committee to accept these changes to the bylaw. Stephen? The motion to accept. Is there a second?
Wait, we have to know. Sorry. Lisa would take a whip to me if I didn't do it this way. Does anybody? Oh, you were asking for a second. Go ahead.
Right.
You do your
right.
part.
Right.
Yeah.
So do we have a second? Dr. Buck, second.
Okay. So does anybody abstain? Okay. Then if you could go through the roll call book.
All right. So we'll start with Don.
So just to clarify, we're voting on the highlighted wording changes in the document that you sent us ahead of time.
The bylaws.
Yes, I approve.
Yes.
All right. Yes, whatever.
Okay. All right. So I'm second. I approve. Jeff?
Approve.
Charlie?
Approve.
Fred Laurie?
Approve.
Steve McDonough?
Aye.
Dietrich Madden?
Approve.
Alexis Thompson?
Approve.
Catherine Wicklund?
Approve.
Andrea Williams?
Approve.
And then for Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, Denise Doherty?
Approve.
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Colleen Boyle.
Approve.
Food and Drug Administration, Kelly Klim.
Approve.
And Health Resource and Service Administration, Michael Liu. And the NIH is absent. Okay, so the outcome is approval. Well, this... Okay, so this is the second time in, that we are ahead of schedule. all right, so either Sarah was being very kind to me in my first attempt to run this meeting and gave me extra time so I wouldn't be behind. So I think we're in good shape. So I think this gives us a little extra time for lunch.
It does, which is good because there's no lunch provided for anybody here. Yes, Colleen.
So can I ask a question?
So you yes, Colleen.
I'm sorry. You presented a lot of other things that were we didn't vote on, which were not part of the bylaws. So when will we come back to those?
Those are programmatic decisions, and that's I wanted to get a discussion
and
an assent as opposed to a vote.
Okay.
All right. Stephen?
I have a question going forward on the reauthorization, since we're involved in making recommendations on some conditions that aren't necessarily genetic, that has there been discussion that the mission would be a newborn screening and heritable disorders that we, as we're going through the process of being recertified or getting approved for another years down the road, do we have to change our title to reflect some of the things we're reviewing and commenting on?
Sarah?
I'm conferring with my loyal colleagues.
Okay, all right.
We're not going to change the name, I can tell you that. I think we need to really carefully consider if newborn screening alone is enough to be within the scope of the advisory committee or not. But I think that it could be argued, even with hyperbilly, that there is definitely a genetic component to it. And so it is there is a heritable component. And so for things that are, as a geneticist, I like to think that I'm very important. I can't think of anything that's not heritable in nature. So, but it is a consideration.
Jeff?
It's a separate topic, but since we're talking about recommendations and process, we had the congenital heart disease recommendation that came along with several additional elements to that, recommendations that were targeted to both HRSA and the NIH. And I think that those came along kind of at the last minute, and as I understand, created a bit of a conversation about the appropriateness of this committee making those sorts of recommendations. So I want to see if there's any conversation about that aspect of the process, because I think clearly we're going to have circumstances where we're not going to make a positive recommendation, but there's data elements out there that we think need to be addressed. We want to make recommendations for how to fill the data gaps for addressing certain kinds of issues. Or we may have positive recommendations along with some specific additional recommendations the way we made with the congenital heart disease statement. So just the question is, do we need a more thought about how that process works to make sure that those additional recommendations are appropriately vetted before we approve them so that they're realistic and that those other agencies can appropriately respond to those?
That is my goal with bringing up the whole idea that what is in the purview and what is not in the purview of the secretary, and to really consider our recommendations as we go forward. One of the provisions that are in the bylaws is that we won't vote unless it's been scheduled. And so that should give adequate time for discussion of recommendations and well thought out placement. But it is definitely, the advisory committee can make any recommendations it wants, whether or not it's actionable and whether or not it's appropriate. I mean, small child can run into the middle. No, never mind. But whether or not we can act on it is a different issue entirely. And it's at the discretion of the advisory committee to make those decisions and to be wise in the recommendations they send forward.
Sarah, this is Fred. Can
yes.
you hear me?
Uh-huh.
I'd like to make a comment, too. I agree with both your statement and the previous one. I'm a little concerned, though, of how it has gone in the past, because in the heart defect situation, the committee really did not consider the effect on the public health laboratories. And when the public comment came, they didn't allow any public comment. And I remember three or four of us from the programs were waiting at the mic, and they wouldn't even let us speak. So although I agree with you that everything is ultimately genetic, we need to narrow it down somewhat, I think, and also in the future, we really do need to consider the appropriateness. And now that the definition of newborn screening has expanded, who exactly should be doing the procedure?
I your point is very well taken, and hopefully that will be included in any of the public health impact analysis that occurs with the conditions review. And again, with the scheduled votes, people will know ahead of time that things are coming up for vote, so that there's ample time for discussion. But I agree.
Right. And the other thing I remember about, if I remember correctly about that vote was not scheduled that day, and then they voted to vote anyway. And so I'm hoping that won't happen again.
Yeah, and we'll.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. I do remember that, and we will. We learn as we go along, because even though we are at 26 meetings, we are really a very young committee, and so we're still learning.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, additional comments? All right. I think that's the other important thing is that that Sarah mentioned earlier is the interaction with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and trying to harmonize our evidence review so that it would be acceptable to the standards that they've created, so that if, as they do with ACIP, the Preventive Task Force does not look at anything related to immunizations, they send that to ACIP. And so in case of newborn screening, there could be issues that they would then, if referred to them, would refer to us. And likewise, there might be issues for conditions nominated that come to us that might better be served there. And I think that looking at it from the beginning all the way to the public health impact is very important for this committee, and that we standardize the way we approach it all the way through. So I think that's part of the goal of this. Okay. Well, if there are no other comments, since we're early,
you said Colleen? Something. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
So, I mean, this is very complicated, obviously, in trying to understand the different lanes. And I know in the early part of this committee, we did have discussions about, you know, what is the lane for this committee? And as Sarah says, most disorders have a genetic component, so that doesn't really help very much. So I don't know if there, and I'm sorry, I've kind of got lost in all the different processes here, but is there a need to, since it sounds like, you know, we're sort of rethinking the committee a bit, to kind of go back to that? You know, is that something that the committee can provide guidance to, both, you know, HRSA, HHS, the secretary, and thinking about that? I don't know, just, and maybe you already said that, and I apologize. And
No, I think that this is the beginning of the discussion, and, okay. And I think that, as has been, as Sarah indicated, our hope is to develop a methods a group or a methods policy book that would then enable us to kind of clarify some of these things, and there will, we are attempting to put together a conference to go ahead and do that.
Yeah. So I see beyond methods. I guess I'm thinking about, thinking about the healthcare system, thinking about the opportunities, thinking about what makes sense. I guess I'm thinking maybe more conceptual than process oriented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's important, and I think we need to have that discussion with the entire committee. Yes, agree.
Or a work group, or whatever.
Right. Yeah. But you're right. Yeah. I think that's essentially where we're beginning that process.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, since we're yeah, so we're going to move the afternoon session to start at 1:30, so that we can get through the afternoon session on schedule. We may be able to then make sure we get all the public comments in, as well as get the rest of the work that is ahead of us before the subcommittee meetings. So if there are no other comments, we will
adjourn.
Restart at 1:30. Thank you all very much. All of the background data for the 22q11 deletion syndrome has to be put on in each computer. So if you'd like to hold on to have that, you've already got? No, okay. So we've got it. It's going to come around to you. So before you head off for lunch, you can get it. Okay. You got it really. This is a new computer, but you just need to push it in. I'll go in. Okay. Okay. So. Oh, this is my remover. This is not your.
No, this is.
Oh, it is. It. Okay. All right. So go ahead.
These two.
Yeah, go ahead and, okay, well, let me do it. I guess I put this. Yeah. Go ahead. You could do it better than me. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay.
Excuse me. Sorry, can I apologize?